I realized something as I was thinking about nap dresses for you. What you're looking for is called a nightgown.
You know, I have a friend who who's been wearing like LL Bean flannel nightgowns as like badass 90s with Docs dresses. And I've got to say, it's That's a hot genius look. It's a hot middle-aged mom look. I'm into it.
I was searching nightgowns for you, and I have to say, some of them are very elegant. Like, that you wouldn't... Look, I wouldn't bat an eye if someone were wearing it as streetwear.
I used to wear slips for dresses.
Oh, well, all we the all time. Lived in the 90s. Hi, I'm Rebecca Cohen.
And I'm Maya Garantz.
And this is The Sauce, the culture and politics podcast where we drink cocktails and ruin the stuff you love.
And today we're going to ruin something that a lot of people love, including us, which is the bizarre TV Netflix show Cobra Kai.
All right. I'm so excited for this topic of Cobra Kai because I watched all three seasons of it. There are only 10 episodes per season, but I watched all of it specifically so we could talk about it. And
it's actually one of my favorite kinds of episodes that we do because it confuses me. It confounds me. And so the only way to deal with its confounding nature is to talk about it with you, frankly.
We're going to come to some answers together. We're going to get to the bottom of this weird show that is Cobra Kai.
But very weird
before
show.
We dive into that, we're going to do our check-in. I want to know how you're doing, Maya, and what are you drinking?
Well, I'm doing quite well. I've had my first round of Moderna, and I am drinking vodka and soda with Meyer Lemon. Yeah, it's very, makes you feel very hopeful when you're in the system, when you're not like, when is it gonna happen for me? It's like in the system. If you're in LA, guys, Dodgers Stadium, all the mega sites have so many fucking appointments. They just want to put it in your arm. Just go.
They just,
you think you don't belong to a category? They actually said to me, just make an appointment and we'll figure out a category for you, which is their way of saying, we need arms to put this into.
Yes.
Get here now.
Yeah, because the stuff doesn't last. It has to stay refrigerated. It doesn't last forever. They really need people now. They actually have the supply. They need people to vaccinate. And I also got my first round of Moderna.
Yay!
So I signed up online. If you are in New York, I think the situation's really similar. You can sign up for an appointment. They have certain categories. It's opened up now. Even more categories are allowed to sign up. I technically didn't meet the criteria, but I hoped that I could fudge it. But when I showed up to get the shot, nobody asked. No one cared what category I was in. No one asked for any proof or documentation or anything. All they wanted was to see that I had the appointment, and I got that was my
it. It's
thing.
The same. It's the same. So can I tell you the most San Diego thing ever?
Sure.
So essentially a lot of these places and states are trying to reach the point where they're like, the categories have outlived their usefulness. How do we let people know that just come and get it?
Yeah.
So in California, one of the pre-existing conditions is obesity, right? Because COVID
It's a comorbidity that can, cause,
absolutely.
Yeah, difficulties.
And that is a BMI of 40 or over, right? San Diego has changed their BMI threshold to 25 or over.
I was waiting
for
the number.
Is that not the most San Diego way to say, just come get your vaccine? Like, I couldn't.
Or it's a very San Diego way of saying, there's a Weight Watchers in North County, you know.
That I grew up there as a ballet dancer and never had an eating disorder is a fucking blessing from God. Like,
that's
I cannot.
Amazing. You know, my sister's gymnastics coach, forgive me if I've already told this story, but my sister's gymnastics coach, who was a Romanian woman in San Diego, told her she needed to lose weight when she was 11.
Okay. Guys, we're just saying, if you're in California and you have a BMI over 25, which is like so many people, just go. They have the doses and they want to put them in your arms.
Or really, if any reason that you think you would like to get a vaccine, just sign up. Worst just case scenario, they won't give it to you, but they probably will.
They probably will. Yeah. Ah, shoot. Sorry. All right. So who?
Wait, I didn't tell you what I'm drinking yet.
Oh my God, what are you drinking?
It's like you don't even care. I really wanted to share this because I'm drinking an Italian Buck, which is a cocktail recipe that one of our listeners, one of our patrons, shared on the Discord.
Yeah.
The Sauce Speakeasy, which is our Discord chat for our patrons. And there's a cocktails thread there. And she was talking about Amaro. Or Amari, which I'm super into also. And this one is made with Amaro Montenegro and Chinar and lime juice and some ginger. I use ginger ale instead of ginger beer, but it's lovely and I'm really enjoying it. So
that's awesome. There's also a very long conversation about the best uses for pecan vodka.
Yeah.
From a small distillery in Mississippi. I was like, yes, this is
this is the cocktail content
that I want. Yeah, it exactly. is awesome. We have a lot of cocktailistas who are listening.
Well, of course we do, but they also
join us.
Yes, there's also conversations about so many other wonderful topics. But yes, if you have thoughts about how to use pecan flavored vodka,
please let our listeners know. There was much discussion about, does this go with apple, the nuttiness? Like, what do you do with that? How do you balance that out? Like, it's great.
Do we have any other updates? Or
I think updates that we're going to share for next week.
Okay.
Save for next week.
Oh, good. All right. Let's leave them wanting a little more, guys. More next week.
Show a little ankle.
But right now, we're going to get started because I really can't wait to start talking about Cobra Kai.
Okay, Rebecca, this was your idea that our first 10 minutes, we just do no spoilers so that the non-Cobra Kai listeners can enjoy some of this discussion before we get into the nitty-gritty.
Yes. We usually just don't bother with that. We just jump into spoilers.
Just don't give a shit.
But
yeah.
I don't know. I thought there's a lot we could say. And I also kind of want to sell the show to people. I want them to know about it if they don't know about it. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to talk for a few minutes in general terms. We will not give away anything that you couldn't have gleaned from watching the trailer or reading a review. And then we'll let you know when it's time to jump into the totally spoiler-filled analysis, which if you haven't seen the show, you can choose if you want to listen or not.
Correct.
But we're going to be giving shit away. All right. So this is the no spoiler portion. Let's talk about this show. Cobra Kai is a show that was on YouTube Red.
For the first season.
But then it jumped to Netflix. It's now on Netflix. You can see all the episodes there. There are 3 seasons currently with 10 episodes each. Very digestible.
Yes.
And it, if you all recall the movie Karate Kid from, anyway, our youth, Cobra Kai was the dojo, the karate dojo that the bad guys, the bullies were in. And that's what the show is about. It is about the characters from Karate Kid. But now it's literally a sequel to the Karate Kid movies.
And I think this isn't giving anything away because you learn it in the first, 10 minutes of the first episode. Mm-hmm. But all of the actors from the original Karate Kid are in this show, all of them.
Yeah.
And we open with Johnny, the bad kid.
Johnny Lawrence. Yeah, played by Billy Zabka.
In his sad, failed middle age. Mm-hmm. And Daniel LaRusso, played by Ralph Macchio, is a very successful owner of a car dealership and is totally bougie.
Yes.
And so you have this kind of flip of a reversal of fortune.
Yes.
And they come back into contact, and that's where the show starts.
Yes.
And every actor, it's almost like they got everyone. Everyone.
Yeah.
Everyone.
It's really, yeah, remarkable. Daniel LaRusso's mother, the actress who played her, she's there as his mom. They all come
back.
If
they're not there, it's because they died.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's it. That's it. And there's something about that where I didn't know this. So Billy Zabka and Ralph Macchio, who are both producers on this thing, they stayed friends over the years because they would go to conventions and be on the circuit together and like hang out as they were getting older and directing and living life and having families. And what I didn't quite understand is that the world of the Karate Kid is thought of as the Miyagi-verse. Is that a thing? That's the fucking Miyagi-verse.
So there's conventions. There's just like Miyagi-verse conventions, like Karate Kid conventions.
I don't know if they're separate conventions, but at cons, there are definitely Miyagi-verse sort of sessions and like...
Sure, panels and presentations.
All that.
And booths.
And so when they created this show, they basically took Karate Kids 1, 2, and 3, and then the next Karate Kid, and they've used that all as like the material for the backstory for everything that they're writing. No,
it is a direct sequel. It is absolutely, these are the same characters, and they have this younger generation also. You have, Daniel has a teenage daughter, Johnny has a teenage son, and then there's other teenagers in the world. Like the, I don't think it's giving too much away, because this is just the basic premise of the show, is that Johnny, through a series of circumstances, comes in contact with a kid who wants him to teach him karate. And so he restarts Cobra Kai and starts teaching that kid. And meanwhile, his own son, whom he's alienated and estranged from, starts getting mentored by Daniel LaRusso. And then the kid that Johnny is mentoring has a crush on LaRusso's daughter, so you get these really interesting little complications.
It sets up a soap opera, but they will actually do flashbacks to all of the original films, so that all the original material that's this kind of iconic teen movie, everybody's seen it, we all have those memories already implanted in our heads, they use it as the actual memories of the characters.
Yeah.
So they don't like recreate it. They like go back to Karate Kid 1 and like,
no, there's literally talk about those flashbacks. Scenes, like, they show scenes that, and it's great, and they don't leave shit out. Like it plumbs the depths of everything that you remember and don't remember from Karate Kid. I love it for that reason.
And you know, I have to say that that's one of the things that I can't believe I'd never heard this term before. Rebecca tells me it's a very well-established term. When everybody was on Twitter talking about watching Coming to America, the Coming to America reboot, which didn't have a single new joke, but somebody said it was great. It was fan service. Like, this show is, and I think this is what makes it fun, this show is fan service in terms of how it goes into the depths of the Miyagi-verse. Like, the Miyagi-verse is text, is like the text.
Yeah.
And they go from there.
Yeah. And it also, it just not only has flashbacks, but like there are references within the show to things that people will remember. And I suppose there were probably Easter eggs in there that I didn't even pick up on, because I'm not such a huge fan of the Miyagi-verse that, you know, I didn't really go back and revisit those movies, and there's probably a lot that I missed. But it's fun for that reason, and it's also fun because it has a sort of general nostalgia for the 80s. You have these characters, like, they're adult characters, they're like 50 years old, but there is still the like Simi Valley Karate Championship of 1984 is still a very big event in their lives, you know? It is an important event that holds an important amount of real estate in their brains, and that's kind of weirdly fun because it obviously has a place in our brains because it was a movie that we loved when we were kids.
Exactly, exactly. And because of the 80s nostalgia, there's a lot of great 80s music. There's a lot of great 80s styles of teen movies. There's a lot of montages to music. There's a lot of really well-shot fight scenes. Like, and as in a musical where when the characters just feel too much, they have to break out into song. In this show, they have to break out into karate.
It's true. Yeah, some of the things that I love about the show, one is karate. Karate, first of all, in the show is just, it's magical. It's just magic. If you know karate, then you can, first of all, you can beat up anyone. No one is ever going to best you physically hand to hand because you know karate. And it doesn't matter how old you are. Like, doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter that torn ACL, not a problem.
Once you've known karate, you will always know it and be good at it and be effective with it. Great. I love that. And I love how karate is just such a big part of all these people's lives. It just,
oh, their interior worlds. Yeah. It becomes this like mate. And here's the thing, though. So we're talking about this like nostalgia, the music, the fan service, where the Miyagi-verse is treated with such care. Every actor shows up. Like, just when you're like, they're not going to get Elizabeth Shue. Like, what? Like, it is all there. And I think what I'm the most fascinated with is that, and the reason I really wanted to talk about it with you, is that the tone of the show is bizarre and I'm still wrapping my head around it. Like, a huge part of the time when I'm watching it, I'm just going, what the fuck am I watching? What the fuck is this? Because it's comedy. Like, the fact that it's sort of nostalgia and playing with those tropes is done in this way that's kind of like funny and ironic, but it's also totally sincere.
Totally serious and sincere. Yeah. It's a drama. It's not outright a comedy.
No.
But it doesn't shy away from humor, and it doesn't take itself seriously. You can definitely say that.
It doesn't take itself seriously, which gives you permission to know that they're kind of playing with you. Like, you're in on all of it. But at the same time that it doesn't take itself seriously, when it gets to the serious scenes, it plays them with full emotion and without a nod or a wink to the audience.
Absolutely.
The tension between that is bizarre. It's bizarre.
It is odd. Yeah. It also, the thing that drew me into it was really strong in the first season. And I will say, for those who haven't watched it or those who've only watched the first season, this first season is its strength. The second and third season have many charms, and we're going to talk about that, but they're not as good. But it does some interesting things with inverting expectations, where you know these characters, or you remember them from your childhood, from these movies in the 80s, and they play upon that, but they also take them in different directions that maybe you weren't expecting, or have things play out in a way that the characters weren't expecting, and it creates an interesting tension, and we can't talk much more about that without getting into spoilers. Well,
But that's the thing, is that it ends up being this show. This is another weird tension where you're watching it being like, what the fuck am I watching? So it's like comedy, but it's also totally dramatic, and it knows it's nostalgic and it does little ironic plays, but it's also totally sincere. It's a show that, just when you're saying like how life happens to you, that's about middle age. Like, I feel like middle age is about, how did I get here? It's like the Talking Head song. Like,
yeah.
Middle age is about like, whoa, life happens and you have no control over it. And all of a sudden you wake up and you're 40 and you're like, whoa, how good things happen, bad things happen. How did I get here? And so it is about aging. The show is basically a show about being middle aged, but then it's also full of these like gorgeous dewy, charismatic children. Yeah. Who are like children, and they're really good at, it's not like the 80s movies where they cast 25-year-olds to play 16-year-olds. They cast young looking kids. So you're like, yeah, these are children. And so then the old guys, even though the show is about middle age, then the old guys are just an anchor for a teenage soap melodrama that you're watching. Like, mm-hmm. It's very strange. I really enjoy the strangeness, because part of watching it is going like, what is this?
All right. I want to talk more about what it is, but we can't do it much more without getting into spoilers. Okay. We're going to get into specifics. So let's do that.
All right.
Here comes the spoiler section.
If you're still here, it's because you're not afraid of spoilers. And right. I want to get into, as we're getting into that, we're getting into like middle age, which is where we kind of left off.
Yes.
Yeah, like the middle age thing is really weird.
Okay, so I have a few things to say about that. First of all, that was interesting what you said about that, like, how did I get here feeling when you're in middle age. You are in a really interesting point. I mean, it's middle age. You're kind of looking back on your life and you're realizing that maybe this is what your life is. Like, you've moved past that whole portion of your life where everything's ahead of you. And you're saying,
and where you go, my life could be anything. Mm-hmm. You're like,
exactly.
Well.
Like, yeah, well, okay, I guess this is what it is.
You know, one thing I always think about, I always just remind myself, like, it's never too late to become a heroin addict.
Side note, you know, sometimes when, you know, I would be, you know, pre-pandemic walking down the street in New York and you see an addict just like lying on the sidewalk in Union Square, and that's very sad, and I hope that they're able to get help of various kinds. But also there's a little bit of envy in me for like, that person doesn't care. Like, they don't care about how dirty the sidewalk is or whose path they're blocking by just like sleeping on the sidewalk. They are so focused. They only care about getting high. And like, that level of focus, I don't know, I kind of envy that.
Oh my God, that is such an ADHD way of seeing things. Okay.
Just knowing what your priorities are, that's all.
Middle age is a very weird time where you are in between. You like, sometimes I look at older people and I go, and then I see a photo of them when they were 20 and I'm like, how did that become that? When you're in middle age, you know how that became that. You're in it.
You're in it.
The middle of whatever you're right. going towards. It's a very bizarre time.
But these characters in this show are very much not living in their present moment. They're very much preoccupied with the past. And that's part of the theme and what the show seems to be getting at. And it's part of the fun, because their past is what interests us. Daniel right. LaRusso, car dealership owner, I don't care about this person. Why would I care right. about him? You know, Johnny Lawrence, new karate sensei, starting his
anti-hero,
own company.
Anti-hero.
Like, I kind of get, like, he's way, way more interesting a character than Daniel LaRusso. But it's still, like, it's not the interesting part of their lives as the lives have been presented to us so far.
Well, and this is one more last thing about tone, about the weird tone mm-hmm. of the show, because it's very much about middle age, is that, so there's this famous scholar, Peter Brooks, who wrote about melodrama and how melodrama makes things morally legible. Like, melodrama is there to say to the audience, this is good, this is bad, and we are going to tell you this through this very melodramatic story. And Cobra Kai, and this is part of its weird tone, it is full melodrama, full, total melodrama, but also everybody gets a backstory to explain why they are doing what they're doing. Like even Kreese, who is the most, you know, irredeemable bad guy. There are no bad guys here. So they're making melodrama out of characters, all of whom have very real reasons for doing good things and bad things. And that's very weird. That's very weird.
It is odd. And I think it goes to some of the inverting of expectation stuff that I mentioned earlier. And it goes to one of the themes of the show, which is about how things aren't black and white and there's no good guys and bad guys and everybody has a story. But with the inverted expectations, like the story that we're given in the original Karate Kid is in a sense more of the melodrama. When I think of melodrama, I think of the like a mustache twisting villain, you know,
the Snidely Whiplash. Yeah, absolutely. Who's
just like a cartoon villain that this person represents evil and that person represents good. And the original movie was more like that. It was like Johnny Lawrence is a bully and Danny LaRusso is a good kid. And John Kreese is a bad sensei and Miyagi's a good sensei. And he's going to teach him the good karate. And it's very black and white, very straightforward. And this show really does want to complicate all of that. And it's kind of funny because there was not a meme exactly, but there was a thing online for a long time about Danny is really the bully in Karate Kid. And if you look at the events of the story, you could absolutely frame it as Danny's the villain. Like he, in the Halloween scene, he gets a hose and douses all the Cobra Kai guys in water. They were minding their own fucking business. They weren't doing anything to him.
Well, but that's also, I feel like what the show is trying to do is say, we want to keep all the things that were fun about the 80s, but then try to remove the things or contend with the ways that the culture has moved on.
Yes.
So that's this meta narrative of the show, which is also very middle age. It's like, I am here. How has this moved on? And one of the ways that you see it is in this weird reckoning that all the middle-aged characters do with kiddo snowflake woke culture. Like kids today, they're snowflakes. They have allergies and care about gender and microaggressions. And they use all this vernacular that I don't know anything about.
Yeah, that's it. That's a big part of the way the show is very explicitly sort of grappling and being like, the world is different. Things are different than they used to be. Like, you have...
But I like that stuff from the 80s. Right, I liked those ass-kicking scenes. But I want to still have that, but also grow and change. So what do I do?
Johnny, as a character, is really the embodiment. He's the stand-in for the viewer's 80s nostalgia, right? He's absolutely the one who's living in the past in the most overt way, though I would maybe argue that Daniel is more so. But in an overt way, he's like talking about 80s music and driving an 80s car and he doesn't use a smartphone or have a Facebook. He doesn't know anything about contemporary culture. He like really is a relic. And so they get a lot of bits. They get a lot of humorous moments out of Johnny's ignorance about technology, ignorance about woke culture, like, yeah, the whole hash brown Me Too.
Hash brown joke. Me Too. Like, they squeeze it in there wherever they can because that's just a throwaway line, but they make sure to get it in there.
But there's a number of throwaway lines. Like, I couldn't even cite all of them, but there's like in almost every episode, there's something that Johnny says that's like a little joke about his ignorance toward woke culture.
Absolutely.
But then
there's the thing about how Daniel LaRusso's has the ad where because he won this All Valley competition a million years ago, he's still using it to advertise his car dealership, which is also this thing where like he hasn't moved on. And somebody goes, oh yeah, your ad is cultural appropriation.
Yeah, it's totally a throwaway joke. Like one of the guys who works in the dealership says, I loved your ad. Don't listen to those people who say it's cultural appropriation. And Daniel's like, what? Cultural what? And he's like, cultural appropriation, but it's totally not. It's totally cool. And that's it. They never revisit that. And it's like, is that hanging a lantern on it? Or is that a joke? Is it supposed to be at Daniel's expense? Is it supposed to be at woke culture's expense?
We just want to acknowledge this so that we can keep having our badass show.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. Hanging a lantern on it, right?
Yeah.
Like, we know what it is, but we're going to do it anyway.
We're going to do it anyway. And that's something about all of that, that kind of the middle age, these men haven't moved on. They know nothing about feelings. All this stuff that's about feelings is super foreign to them. Gets us to this massive theme about masculinity and particularly middle-aged masculinity. It's like,
it's all connected.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Yeah. So the show, yeah, they're grappling with a changing world that seems to have, and but that is middle age, right? The world has changed. It's like that Homer Simpson line, I used to be with it, but then it changed, and what I was with wasn't it anymore, or something like that.
And also the fact that, like, when you grow up, you're given this picture of what the world is gonna be, but then by the time you're an adult, that changes. And so you're like, but when I was little, I thought it was going to look like this when I grow up. So, like, yeah, you're always kind of running behind.
So before we get into the specifics of the masculinity and the way the show is dealing with masculinity, that actually, what you just said is interesting, because I feel like for the Daniel LaRusso character, the world is exactly everything he was told it would be, right? So This is one of the things that I can't grasp about the show, that
just it sort of slips out of your fingers
every time you try to hold on to it.
It just slips out.
The Johnny character is really well realized. He's really dimensional. You start to understand why he was ever a bully and why he hated Daniel. And I loved the storyline with him in the first season mentoring Miguel. Because being the sensei to Miguel, because Miguel was being bullied, and then Johnny teaches him the Cobra Kai tactics and ethic and ethos. He teaches him the whole the no mercy.
Yeah, strike first, strike hard, no mercy.
Right. He teaches him that ethic, and the kid embraces it and becomes confident and learns to defend himself and then asks out the girl, and he's happy, and it's like enriched his life. And this nerd, somebody that Johnny as a teen would have beaten up, is now so much happier and having a better life because he has learned strike first, strike hard, no mercy. And then all the other nerds show up at the dojo, and Johnny's like, these aren't the kids I thought I was going to teach, but he does. And then the nerds become really cool and confident because of these incorrect teachings. And I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah.
I loved that inversion of expectations, that the wrong karate message is having a very positive effect
on these kids.
So maybe maybe it's more complex than Daniel might have thought it was. And meanwhile, the character of Daniel LaRusso is like, he has nowhere to go. His life is what he thought it would be. He didn't know what to do with his life, but then he knew he liked cars, so he started a car dealership. He's wealthy. He's got a beautiful, wonderful wife. He's great house. Everything's fine. Like, his only problem is Johnny. And that's not even a real problem. It's an imagined problem.
It's not that it's an imagined problem. This reminds me of this one. I remember this one guy who broke up with me. And he got back in touch with me to sort of years later to kind of apologize for how he had been to me. And I realized, like, why is he apologizing? Like, that was years ago. I don't care. But I was his previous girlfriend to the one he was dating. So in his memory, I was closer in time. And since then, I had had a lot more, so it was further away in time for me. And I think this brings me to masculinity, where, like, these men haven't moved on. they are in their 50s and they are still stuck in high school. Like they have it, like it's astonishing that they're, and what's weird about the women in the show is that they're surrounded by all of these smart, brilliant women who are only there to manage them and manage their masculinity and manage their mm-hmm. toxic masculinity mm-hmm. and to manage their shit and deal with their shit and solve their shit for them. Because in all of the things that happened in their life, the one thing that they didn't understand is that, like, their feelings aren't what the world is. Like, that there's life and then there's how you feel about life. And you're like, wow. Wow, that's a pretty big indictment of masculinity.
Yeah,
that's
a really good read. And it is truly like the essence of what's going on in the show, right? That they don't understand that their feelings are not what is. And yeah. That is what Allie basically tells them in the like last episode of season three, where she's like, there's your story, and then there's your story, and then there's the truth.
And when she said that, I totally thought she was, because she's like, there are three stories. There's your story and your story. And I thought she was going to say, and my story.
I totally thought so too. She was going to be like, hey, there's other people outside your own fucking heads. And some of them are women and your behavior affects us. Yeah. Like it was not at all what she was saying. The women really do kind of exist as padding sort of.
It's not as padding, it's as facilitators. Mm. They're like therapist facilitators. They're not just there, like they're there to like sort of be so emotionally more.
I feel like Allie plays that role, but I don't know, like Daniel's wife.
Totally plays that role.
Do you think?
Oh my God, she totally plays that role.
I feel like she more plays that the foil, like that the wife always has to play on TV shows where the male protagonist is, you know, doing his thing and off on his mission, and she has to be the one questioning it and doubting it and warning him about it and being the wet blanket, basically. And even though she's a dynamic, great character, well played and fun to watch.
She's such a good actor. Yeah, yeah.
She is kind of the wet blanket in the sense that she's the one who's like, are you sure you have time to do a karate dojo? Is this a good idea?
But she's also like, do you see how your emotional grudges are playing out now?
Yeah.
Do you see how dumb this is?
Like, that's true.
She's not just a wet blanket where she's like the harassing wife who's like, I just don't like it. Like, she's like, this is not emotionally healthy. And this is kind of like, like that's, and I feel like that's what the women do. Like mm-hmm. they facilitate these men,
yeah.
And they don't motivate anything, they just solve things.
That's
and these men
true.
In their 50s cannot, like, they cannot get it together, which is then weird that the whole show is about like the father figure.
Yes.
It's like, yeah, but when fathers don't know shit because they're 50 and still dealing with what happened in high school.
But that's literally what, like, that's what the show's about, though. That is right. Exactly what the show's about, because it's about these characters who were the students becoming
yes.
the mentors, right?
Yes.
Who were the sort of figurative sons becoming the literal and figurative fathers. And the show
yes.
is all about that. It's about how Johnny starts out teaching his students what he was taught by his mentor, father
right.
figure. And then we even find out in season three that Kreese learned that from his mentor figure, who was the army guy who taught him to have no mercy. And by the way, I fucking love those Vietnam flashback scenes.
Oh,
they're
yeah.
so, it's like out of nowhere. It's this goofy show about karate and they live in the valley and there's teenagers. And then it's like, oh, you fucked up. And now all of your platoon are POWs and one guy got shot in the head because you didn't have no mercy. Like, oh damn.
Right. Well, I know. And it also brings back a character that was a very big 80s trope, which is the fucked up Vietnam vet.
Yeah, the
which
Vietnam
is like
vet.
we really reinscribe that character into our present imaginary.
Absolutely.
Like, hey guys,
like, I didn't,
that war was fucked up and it fucked up a lot of people.
I did not remember that being an aspect of that character from the movies, but they really emphasize it here. They're like, this guy was in Vietnam. That's what you need to know.
The bad war.
The bad war.
I mean, Miyagi was in World War II. That was the good war.
That's
that was
true. Okay war. That's true. But speaking of Miyagi and the topic of father, sons, mentor, students, to me, that's one of the major areas where the show has trouble is the absence of Mr. Miyagi. You can have Johnny dealing with trying to figure out who he is and what he wants to pass on to his students when he starts to see the error of what he was taught. But that's an interesting journey. That's a person trying to make the transition to being a mentor.
Yes.
But with Daniel, they're trying to explore this idea of him figuring out how to do this thing that Mr. Miyagi did. But Daniel himself, he's kind of a, he's not a likable character in and of himself. Like Daniel LaRusso, even in the movies, he's kind of a little dick, and like you can get away with it when you're a young Ralph Macchio and he's kind of cute and
toothpicky kid being beat up by the bullies.
He's just got this like, oh, I'm from Brooklyn or wherever he's supposed to be from. I'm from Queens and I got this kind of New York equality. I don't quite fit in. I just say things how they are. And you have Mr. Miyagi who's the foil. He's the contrast to that. So they can drive each other nuts. But they can learn from each other. And Miyagi has the calm and the wisdom. So Daniel can always be like, but why do I have to do this? But what? That don't make any sense. And Miyagi can be like, just do it. And then he learns. And there's a journey. There's a fucking journey.
But also part of the journey is that Miyagi didn't have a son. Like, doesn't have a wife. And like, has and is living a really lonely, actually a life much more like Johnny's life. He's a drunk. He's like by himself in a corner. He has no purpose to, he has nobody to like give this information to.
Yes. That's very well noted. So that's a beautiful mentor-student relationship, right? They grow from each other. They learn from each other. They both are enriched by the relationship. In the show, as far as Daniel's concerned, it's just a lot of like, well, Mr. Miyagi used to say, and Mr. Miyagi used to do, and I wish I could be more like, what would Mr. Miyagi do? And that's just not interesting, and it's not helpful, and I don't know what would have worked better, but it kind of reminds me of the Star Wars sequels, especially with Luke Skywalker, but also Han Solo, and like, you're trying to take these characters who were the young upstarts who needed to be guided and shaped by the mentor characters. Now, these young characters have become the mentors. How do you manage that transition? There's a few ways you can do it, but number one, the character being mentored has to be interesting.
Yes.
You can't, like...
Yes. Yes.
Miguel is fucking interesting. That actor, that young actor is dynamic and fun to watch. And he really draws you and makes you want to watch him more. Robbie, that kid, like, I feel like I can imagine the casting session where they are looking for a handsome young man. And they're like, you're good looking. Could you scowl? Great. Oh, great. You're going to be great, you know?
Perfect.
He has a lot of potential as a character, as the neglected son who's had to sort of look after himself
and for himself.
Make it on his own. And then he encounters Daniel. There's a lot of potential there. And Daniel has the wisdom passed on from Mr. Miyagi. But they're so caught up in making Daniel not have really grown over the past 30 years, that he doesn't have a rich and beneficial for both kind of relationship with his students.
Part of this is that I remember the moment when I became an adult. I remember it because I remember the moment being like, why am I always so mad at my mom and how she treated me when I was growing up? When instead I should have been mad at my dad, who was so absent as a father that my mom had to do everything.
You know? Like, it's the moment your mom has been waiting for you to have.
Well, yeah, but she still can't accept it because she's controlling and weird and has some issues. But here's the thing.
Yes.
It's that moment where you go, oh, this person that I love who hurt me in ways or who guided me in ways is flawed.
Yeah.
And that's something that Johnny gets to have with Kreese. It's like, this guy is flawed. I'm going to give him the second chance. I have the capacity to understand the way that he was fucked up. I have more empathy for him in some ways. And I have more boundaries that I have to set in other ways, right?
Yes.
Daniel never gets to have this moment where he's like, oh, this was the limit of Mr. Miyagi, and this is where I have to move on.
Yes.
That he chose really to be by himself. Noted. He chose to not take care of to move on and have a family after his wife died. Like, he just couldn't. He was a drunk. And that's what middle age partly is too. Like, that there are no heroes anymore, but there are also no villains anymore. You understand why the bad person did bad things. You understand why the good person isn't as good as you think it is. Like, and that.
Yes, that's growing
that
up.
That isn't there.
Yeah.
That's growing up.
There is the moment where Daniel goes to Okinawa and has the whole encounter with Chosen, his rival from Karate Kid 2. And it there's some implication. Chosen's whole thing is, oh, he didn't share everything with you about Miyagi karate, did he? And
right.
There's potential there for this idea of, like, Miyagi karate might actually not be exactly what Daniel thought it was.
Right.
Might not be this, like, passive self-defense, all good thing. But then, not really. It really is. Everything's fine. And...
yeah.
He doesn't really learn something useful from it.
Isn't that part of middle age? Isn't that part of growing up? Like, you understand your parents, you understand your
that
heroes.
I mean, that's one of the central...
that they're people.
Yeah. Recognitions. Like, yeah. It's like recognizing your parents are people, that they're flawed, that they're human beings. Absolutely.
Parents are people with children. Did you ever have a Free to Be You and Me when you were
yes.
growing up?
No. Oh, okay, God. So I never had it, but, like, everyone I knew had the tape. So,
oh, yeah. Parents are people with children. The first time Ben and I heard that when our son was a baby, we just both burst out crying. Like, we are people. We are.
It's true. So, yes, it's all tied together. Masculinity, middle age, fathers / male mentors and sons, the difficulties of trying to be a mentor and father, the poignancy of Johnny not being able to, like, father his own son, but finding
yes.
himself coming into his own as a father, not being able to do that for his own son, but he has another young man, student who
and
steps
being
in.
Torn between the two sons
yeah.
right at the moment where they both
sure.
need him, and choosing the one who's not his blood son.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some good stuff in there. There's some good stuff. There's also, like, speaking of the women being just sort of the facilitators and stuff like that, like, you have Samantha. She exists. That's the daughter, right? She exists just to instigate the plot for the men. Although
yes.
there is Tori, who I kind of want to talk about.
I want to talk about Tori because Tori could be so easily just turned into, like, bad girl. Like, she is just she could be the female Kreese, the teenage female Kreese,
mm-hmm.
the poison ivy, so easily. And again, they make sure to, like, where she's coming from. Like,
absolutely.
She grew up in this hard knock situation where she's like, oh, this is going to teach me how to fight because this world wants me to fail.
Yeah.
And I don't want to
so.
Fail.
Yeah. And you can see how the Cobra Kai approach to karate and life would be meaningful to her, would appeal to her and be helpful to her, because it is about, like, no one's going to look out for you. You have to look out for yourself. No one's going to have mercy. You can't have mercy. Like, that makes perfect sense to her in her life.
Yes.
And it,
yes,
it is a good example of the theme that we've talked about of this idea, no good guys or bad guys. Everybody has a story and things are complex. Yes. And everyone has their reasons. Everyone has their hurt inside that makes them do the things they do, even Chris.
Yes.
But, and I really appreciate that with Tori. I mean, there are a few issues. Like, she just shows up. She's just suddenly there in the story for no reason. They're just like, here's this character. She's here now. She does karate. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she's okay. I want to give the show time to do something interesting with her character, because she does actually have a surprising amount of depth. I don't exactly understand her total obsession with Sam.
Oh, I do. I do. I feel like there is that thing about, like, and I think that part of it is that Sam has no answer for it, where she's like, you're just some little princess who has never had to deal with any struggle in your fucking life.
My
and
God.
You are going to get
I just remembered,
everything you ever
I'm
want.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just remembered there's that scene at the beach club where Sam accuses her of theft.
Yes.
For no like with no justification.
Yeah.
Just accuses her of theft.
Yeah.
And Sam never really is held to account for that. She never apologizes for that or recognizes her error.
She's humiliated. And that seems to be enough, but she doesn't learn from it.
Yeah, like, there's no indication she learned.
Like, there isn't a way of saying, like, so far Sam has no answer for the fact that she's just a spoiled princess who, like, has never had to deal with shit. Like, she has zero answer for that. When Tori comes at her with that, I'm like, yeah, well, she's kind of got you there. Because she's also not an interesting enough character.
Right.
Like, you she might excuse that in a character who's like, yeah, but she's smart. She sees the complexity of her life. She challenges this kind of background that she comes from. She sees these things.
See,
she doesn't.
Here's a great opportunity that the show is missing. And there's a few missed opportunities in the show, if we're being honest.
Okay.
But Tori, in Sam's point of view, is just a bully. Tori just is mean and wants to beat her up. And Sam wants to learn how to defend herself and get all the Miyagi-Do kids to defend themselves. But then she turns out to be the big pussy and can't do so when push comes to shove, blah, blah, blah. But there's an opportunity there to see the recreation of the Johnny and Daniel dynamic in relationship.
Absolutely. There's an opportunity for class warfare.
Yeah. Well, the class warfare is definitely there, and it's definitely a theme throughout the thing, and it's there, if not forefronted.
Right.
But they could take that and just really make Sam be a little more like her dad. Be a little more, like, they showed her being judgmental, accusing this girl of theft for no reason, but they want to write Sam like she's just the good girl. She's a good girl. She's a good girl. She means well. And they don't know how to write a character who's good and a girl and in any way interesting. So she has kind of no internal conflict. She has no, the only conflict she has is the external one coming from Tori. And,
well, and these external desires coming from these boys.
Oh,
that
the
she
boys.
Likes.
No.
And,
see,
and at least in the beginning, she was a little like dealing with being a popular girl. There's very much the kind of like mean girl story. Like, I'm trying to play along with these popular girls. Like, they have that, but it's nothing very notable.
They can't settle on one thing that's going to be her thing, because there's no foundation there.
Like, they could set up something where it's like a tension with her mom or a tension with her dad, but they also can't bear to have Daniel LaRusso maybe like not being a great dad, or like
right.
They have to set up more conflict in the house that's kind of endemic to the house for that to work, and they're very unwilling to do that because they need to be like, look at this functional family,
right.
Like, there is
they're
a functional
the good
family
functional family
right
which is fine, but you could just go with the whole the judgmental thing. You could go with the, like, she's making some errors. She's not fucking perfect. Like, she makes some errors. She doesn't take the time to recognize that this girl has her own point of view and her own issues. And then the adults could learn from that.
That, you're right.
They could say, oh, this sheds light on our own situation.
Well, and that's something that I feel like when I'm trying to think about myself as a high schooler. Like, I was a good girl. I was a very good girl. I was also obnoxious and, neurotic and, like loud and dealt with my insecurities in these weird performative ways. And they give that stuff to another male character. Mm-hmm. But they're never going to give it to a female character. You know what I mean? Like the ways that I had this kind of jangly nervousness that came with being a good girl who felt super trapped by her environment. Like, there's ways of portraying that show it in, that allow it to be sympathetic and also, like, annoying or weird or, like, end up making mistakes or, like, all of those things. And they don't kind of give that to her. Like, they're so afraid of making her unlikable. That's what it is.
That they make her nothing. She's not likable at all. And the whole second season.
But being bland is better than being unlikable. Like, to make a complex woman, people might not like her. And it's really important to the show that you like her.
But
and it's like,
why? I don't get that.
That's the question.
Like, they had her friend who was in the first two seasons, the nerdy friend who joined Cobra Kai.
Cobra Kai, right.
I can't remember
I thought that was a great story. Yeah.
And then she kind of becomes, friends with Tori. And then she just disappears after the second season.
I know.
So, like, I wanted to know what happened to that character. She was actually interesting.
Right.
All right. So, what have we arrived at here?
Well, I feel like a lot of what we're seeing is that, like, this show lives in this really bizarre middle space between all of these things.
Yes.
And that's what makes it so weird that you keep watching, because you're like, this is so weird. And that's also what is making it, like, unsettling. And it's like, it's trying to have everything. It's trying to have its cake and eat it too. It's trying to go, hey, we're hip to the woke language, but we're making fun of it. But we also take it seriously. But we also show how it doesn't work. Like, it's trying to, we want our 80s, but we also want to say that we know that we've moved on from our 80s.
Yeah, I hear that. Especially the stuff about woke culture makes me think of the conversation that we had, I think, about Saturday Night Live, that the show, it does seem to be living in that space where, it's sort of like one of the responses to Marxist cultural theory is that rather than viewing pop culture as being propaganda that the powerful classes use to control the people.
The masses.
Or viewing a popular culture as something that is an expression of, like, the popular imagination and the popular will in some way, because people shape what they're going to see via their buying dollar and so forth. Rather than seeing it one of those two ways, you could look at popular culture as this place of negotiation between those two forces.
Right.
It's where the dominant ideas, the dominant ideologies are present, but also subversion of those ideas is played with. And I do think you see that, especially in regard to things like the woke culture jokes, where you could also read it very different ways. They're making fun of this character for not being with it. They're making fun of being with it as being stupid.
Right.
You know, right. And a lot of the 80s nostalgia as well. They're making fun of him for loving the 80s, or they're actually saying the 80s are really cool. And we miss them.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they're making fun of the 80s, but also Miguel gets sensation in his legs back because he goes sees Dee Snider.
Exactly.
In concert, right?
Exactly.
Like, you know, like, and they have that one opening scene where he's fantasizing about Miguel's mom. And it's
the dream montage was so amazing.
And it was totally, and there's this way where it's like both ridiculous, but done completely sincere. Like, she never winks to the audience like, I know this is silly. She's like, yeah, I'm Tawny Catane. You're like, what?
But that's what makes it work in those humorous moments. You have to commit to that kind of thing. It wouldn't work if it were winking. It wouldn't work if it were overtly self-referential. It has to be... I appreciate what you were just saying about it being these contradictory things at once. It's funny and it's silly and it's self-mocking, but it's also completely serious. It's giving all these characters motivations that are well-developed and dimensional and interesting, but also it's this really surface rivalry.
And you know what as we're talking about it and you bring up the sort of Marxist, like, mm-hmm. pop culture as a location of negotiation, I think that Cobra Kai might be peak pop culture. And I think that that's why it's so hard to unwind it, because it is subverting and criticizing dominant culture. And it is serving dominant culture.
Yes.
At the same time. And it's doing both so with such total commitment that it's bizarre.
It's like, so you're just watching it strange.
And you're like, what? And
what
it's like,
am I watching?
Is,
right?
What is this? And that's what it is. It is like the most ridiculous all the way. It's going to do it all the way. It's going to both... sort of look at how sad middle-aged masculinity is, and yet middle-aged masculinity is what is driving the whole show.
The entire show. Yeah.
The entire purpose of this show is to, for these writers to just work out their issues with middle-aged masculinity.
It's basically true. I would never have thought that I would enjoy a show that's based off that quite as much as I've enjoyed this one.
Well, guys, all right. Ooh, I feel like very satisfied by that. I feel like we actually did it. I actually feel resolved.
Okay.
In a way that I did not an hour ago.
I am very glad to hear that. I do feel some resolution, but there's still so many things about the show that stick in my mind, like narrative choices that they made that I don't understand why, meandering stories, conflicts that came up in an episode and you're like, ooh, this is going to be an interesting conflict. And then they resolve it in the same episode, like 10 minutes later.
Yeah.
It really felt like they did have some idea where they were going in an overarching, like, this is where we want to wind up. But they did not know how they were going to get there, and they just sort of like making it up on the fly or something.
They get it and they don't get it. Like, there are times when they get it, there are times when they don't. They throw the pasta against the wall. They see if it sticks. Sometimes it does. Sometimes
the show
it doesn't.
Is kind of like that, definitely. But it's definitely fun to watch. The karate fights are fun. And the moments, for me, the moments where it is totally, totally understands what it is and is just having fun with it, like the dream sequence, like in every karate fight or every time the two dojos come face to face, there's like the one little blonde kid with glasses and the one little Asian kid that look like they're about 12. And we don't know who these kids are. I don't know if we even know their names, but they right. always like are matched up and they hate each other.
I know.
Fighting.
Well, but that's another thing that I really appreciate is that like so many of these kids are like super little skinny shrimpies.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
then the magic of karate makes them like be yeah, able to
they
like
can do whatever. Kick.
They yeah. can do anything.
They have to do.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, my friends. You tell us what you think about Cobra Kai. Join our Patreon so you can come on Discord and talk to us. We've been having amazing conversations about Woody Allen and Michael Jackson and Amaro and Pecan Vodka and
many other things. If you go to patreon.com/saucepodcast, you can check out our Patreon and see the different levels you could join at. Any level you join at, you can join us on the Sauce Speakeasy. So you can find it all at patreon.com/saucepodcast. And you can also reach out to us via email. We are saucepodcast@gmail.com.
If you are looking for me in my nap dresses, I am at Maya Garance. Anywhere you are looking for Maya Garances.
You can find me as at GynoStar on all the various platforms. We have some really exciting episodes coming up, including a special guest
who is also an incredible badass and has agreed to come on the show. So that's next week, and we're really excited.
All right. Until then, adios, amoebas.